I'd like to call the meeting of.
Recording in progress.
I'd like to call the meeting of the Retirement Committee, Orange County Water District to order. Can we have a roll call, please?
Roll call, Director Rowe.
Director Rowe.
Here.
Director Amezcua.
Director Amezcua.
Present.
Present.
Director Bilodeau.
Director Bilodeau.
Present.
Present.
Director Yeo.
Director Yeo.
Director Whitaker.
Director Whitaker.
Director Whitaker.
Director Whitaker.
Director Meeks.
Director Meeks.
Director Nguyen.
Director Nguyen.
Director Tran.
Director Tran.
Looks like he's on.
On.
Director Sheldon.
Director Sheldon.
Director Green.
Director Green.
Jason Dadakis.
Jason Dadakis.
Here.
Kevin O'Toole.
Kevin O'Toole.
Here.
You do have a quorum.
You do have a quorum.
Okay, thank you so much. Now it's time for visitor participation. Is there anybody here that wishes to address the committee or board on items of interest to the public? Please identify yourself and speak.
I don't see any hands.
Okay, then move on to, are there any items too late to be agendized?
There are not.
There are not.
Okay, then we're moving on to consent calendar, which is the minutes of the October 25th, 2022 committee meeting.
I'll move approval. I'll move approval.
This is Kevin. I'll second that.
Kevin, I'll second that.
Okay, thank you. We have a second. Can we have any other comments or questions? Let's move on with a vote.
Okay, roll call. Director Rowe.
Director Rowe.
Yes.
Director Amezcua.
Director Amezcua. Yes.
Director Bilodeau.
Director Bilodeau.
Yes.
Yes.
Jason Dadakis.
Jason Dadakis.
Yes.
Yes.
Kevin O'Toole.
Kevin O'Toole.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, that motion carries, with,
that
five
motion
yes
carries
votes.
With five yes votes.
Excellent. All right, then matters for consideration. We have the one item, money. I'll let Stephanie take over from here.
Sure, thank you. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Scott Sutherland, our advisor.
Stephanie, can you hear me? I'm sorry. Everybody except Director Whitaker is echoing, including myself. Is anyone else getting that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting that.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, just wanted to mention that.
So good morning, everybody.
Good morning, everybody.
Looks like I'm on the echoes. Well, we will forge forward. Let me know if you want to change anything technology-wise. All right, so we'll start with minutes from October 25th that were just approved. So in this agenda, we had three funds from the 457 plan that were on red flag and two from the 401A plan. Today's version of our meeting is going to cover all of the funds from the 401A plan and any existing red flags or 457 funds we wanted to bring to your attention. So we started the last meeting as we do today, reviewing the meeting minutes. We went through a market economic review. And then the next part of this section is showing the changes that we made. No changes to the money purchase plan. In the 457 plan, we did change the mid-cap growth fund is now the Delaware Ivy mid-cap growth using the zero revenue R6 shares, the lowest cost shares. And then the 401A, we still have red flag on the Mass Mutual mid-cap growth, which we're going to cover today. We have the Goldman Sachs inflation protected securities, also still red flag being covered today. In the 457, we have a red flag on the JP Morgan emerging markets, which was a red flag in that last meeting. The Parametric International Equities red flag. And then item number C here is we actually made a change in the mid-cap. We took out Hartford mid-cap growth and added Delaware Ivy mid-cap growth. So all the other funds were meeting or exceeding their benchmarks. The balances as of September 29th. Of last year, the 457 plan, just under $30,029,761, held by 264 participants. The average balance in the 457 plan is $112,000. So I have a little bit different version today of the market commentary because it was kind of a summary of 2022 that I thought would be helpful for everyone to hear. So those are some performance information for the major indexes, but it's not quite the same version that you've seen before. We'll go back to that next quarter, but I thought this was a good summary to kind of look at how 2022 worked out. So the first chart you're looking at here is showing the S&P 500 over the course of 2022. It was certainly a down year, as everybody knows, but the high of the year was the first day of the year and pretty much got worse from there. But you can see the downturn here outlined with the little boxes, bubbles around, telling you all the different news events that happened during the year that impacted the markets. I think it's interesting to see, when surprising to some people, that we had lows in June, then a very significant rally, and then the lows that were in kind of late September, right around the time third quarter statements printed. So they wanted to make those look as bad as we possibly could. So right around the 9:30 date, the stock market hit a bottom. And then the fourth quarter ended up being a positive quarter for the market. Certainly not enough to bring the markets back to positive for the year. But the overall S&P, we can see, was down about 19% for the year. Certain parts of the market were down more than that. Certain parts of the market were down far less than that. So we'll kind of go through that today. Some things that kind of came through, you know, certainly as we're looking at this entire year, the big worries were about inflation. So the CPI in June hit 9.1%, which is the highest level we've had since 1981. So that was certainly a big part of it. What would probably surprise people is to look at that bubble on the upper right, the West Texas Intermediate crude hit a 2022 low. So as much as oil stocks and energy stocks were the best performing category last year, the price of oil was actually down in 2022. So we know that inflation was significant. The labor market remained quite tight. So these numbers here in the purple bars are telling you the new jobs added each month. So great news for the economy, but certainly that need for labor is creating inflation. There's a lot of wage inflation out there in terms of people changing jobs to get increases in pay. But you can see throughout the year, very solid in terms of the numbers and growth of in the job markets. And then this chart is actually showing you here with the purple line that's trending downward is the S&P 500. So starting the year just under 4,800, finishing at around 3,800. But then you have this stair step level going the other direction, which is the pace at which the Federal Reserve raised the Fed funds rate. So a lot of people think it's, I hear that all the time, that the Fed is raising interest rates everywhere. The Fed controls the discount rate and the Fed funds rate, which have impacts on a lot of other rates, including the prime rate in the overall bond market, but it's not a direct impact. It can go the other way. And since about October, we've seen interest rates start to fall anywhere in that, say, 3 to 30-year bond range, even though the Fed is still pushing higher with the very, very short-term rates. So you can see this stair-step fashion, how fast they moved up rates. We started the year essentially at zero, ended the year at 4.5%. That's the fastest pace, not only in a calendar year, but in an up cycle in interest rates that the Federal Reserve has ever raised interest rates. So one of the reasons you're seeing both stocks and bonds perform poorly in 2022 is because the Fed raised rates so quickly. That rate hike creates a lot of competition. So stocks with a dividend of 1% or 2% suddenly don't look as good if you can get 4.5% on your short-term money. And it certainly is going to squeeze companies' profits because their interest costs are higher. Their wage costs are higher, their input costs are higher from inflation. So all things that impact the stock prices as well. So if you look at the overall market here in terms of what interest rates change, so the darker blue is the 10-year note. The 10-year note is the benchmark for the mortgage market. Then there's a 30-year bond, which kind of traditionally we think of as the long bond. And then there's the 2-year note. And you notice we started the year with the 2-year note around 0.75% over here on the left. Finished the year at around 4% plus, but note that the 2-year note is paying more than the 10 and 30-year note. 10 and 30-year note kind of married at the hip here in the last 4 or 5 months, pretty similar in terms of rates. But what that's telling you is you have an inverted yield curve. An inverted yield curve is where short-term interest rates are higher than longer-term rates. That's not normal. Normally, you have a yield curve that actually slopes higher because you're trying to incentivize investors to put money further out in the future by rewarding them with a higher interest rate. But what this tells us is the Fed is definitely trying to slow the economy down. Inverted yield curves almost always lead to a recession, which is why a lot of the market is expecting a recession sometime in 2023. And then commodities, That was kind of the big news of the year, and I'd referenced this earlier, but you can see that the oil prices spiked from the start of the year quite a bit, and then actually peaked out, hit a level in March and then June, and actually trended down from there. And at the bottom here is the S&P 500. So there's 11 different sectors that make up the S&P 500, the biggest portions of which tend to be the information technology or the tech sector, as some people call it, and the communication service categories. So this is showing you the overall S&P down 19%. The energy category was up 59%. So remember, those stocks were the worst performers in 2020 when the economy was essentially shut down. So they had a huge recovery to make. Utilities didn't do so bad, down 1%. Consumer staples like your groceries, going to the Kroger market, only down 3%. Healthcare down 3%, so they held up well. Industrials down 7%. Financials down 12%. Banks actually like this market because they're still paying you very little on your cash in the bank. Maybe it's a touch more on the few CDs, but now they're doing loans at 6% instead of at 2%. For your home, and then materials down 14%. Real estate hit hard with the jump in interest rates, down 28%. Technology, which had been the big winner between 2017 and 2021, is down 29%. Consumer discretionary, so those are the things that we buy when we feel good about things. So it can be cars, it can be washing machines, but also Amazon, the stock itself, is 25% of that benchmark all by itself because it's such a big company. Amazon stock, like a lot of these big technology names, got hit hard last year. So that brought that benchmark down 37%. And then communication services, which houses some quiet stocks like AT&T and Verizon, but now also houses Meta, the old Facebook, and Google, which parent company is named Alphabet, which were hit hugely last year. So down 40%. So you'll see that last bit, which is the abbreviation, probably you guys have heard of FANG stocks, which is supposed to be Facebook, Alphabet, Netflix, and Google, or Apple, Netflix, and Google. They've added a few other names there to get Microsoft in there, but you can see that category that was the big winners of the market, down 42%. So a lot of people that invested their own money would have mutual funds that had big holdings in those stocks, and then they would also hold those stocks themselves. And last year was a pretty difficult year. So here we're looking at the five biggest winners in the S&P 500 and the five biggest losers. So all the winners were energy or oil-related companies. And then the biggest losers were Tesla, Silicon Valley Bank, Align Technology, Match Group, and Generac Holdings, which makes home generators. So some pretty big hits in a few of those stocks that had been huge winners prior to that. Last thing I'll show you is this chart here is showing you the performance of the market essentially in three different brackets. The first half of the year, which is on the left, so January 3rd through June 30th, and you can see pretty big double-digit losses for almost everything. And then the second half of the year, in which some things still lost money, but a lot of things actually were up in the second half of the year, and then the overall performance for the year. So a lot of the damage done in the first half, a lot of markets going sideways ever since then. Okay, so I covered a lot there. Questions for me about that?
Any questions?
Yes, thank you.
Well, Scott, I have a question. Did the Ukraine war have much to do with how the economy went last year?
You definitely saw the Ukraine war impact, you know, with Russian troops invading Ukraine here on the chart. So you definitely saw an impact when it came to energy prices. That was the first kind of March spike in terms of energy prices, which we saw, where was that, here. And then you definitely saw an increase in food prices. I think a lot of people were impacted by how much groceries went up in 2022. So because Ukraine and Russia are big growers for a lot of commodities like wheat, you definitely saw inflation impacted for that. So I think the first half of last year, you definitely saw an acceleration in the inflation trends because of the war. But now you're starting to see those things equalize as supply is caught up with the demand. That's a good point. That was definitely a big part of last year.
All right. Well, thank you. It was quite a roller coaster ride. Let's hope we never have one of those again.
We'll cross our fingers. All right. So questions before we dig into the style boxes here? All right, so this is looking at the 401A plan. These are not return numbers, but where the assets are allocated. So we have our domestic equities here at the top. On the left-hand side is value. On the right-hand side is growth. In the middle is blend, which is typically a combination of the two. The most famous benchmark is the S&P 500 index. So you can see that's under large cap blend. So in theory, that's 250 growth companies blended with 250 value companies. It's never quite that exact, but that's kind of the basis of blend. And typically with most retirement plans that we see out there that we work on or that we see in the marketplace, you typically have your index funds or your blend funds, and then you often have active managers using your value and growth. It's not exclusive to that, but certainly those are the trends. So a large blend, which is a big portion of the plan, about 10% of the plans in the S&P 500. Hartford Core, which is actively managed, is 5%. Parnassus Core is 1.5%. Over to the right, the category that used to be the hottest, which has cooled off, is that large growth category where a lot of those technology names were. It's about 5% of money in there between T. Rowe Price, all cap opportunities. And then we do have an index fund there offered for large growth. Below that, in mid-cap growth, we have JP Morgan mid-cap growth and Mass Mutual, each representing about 1% of the plan. Mass Mutual on red flags, so we're reminding you of that there. Below that, in small caps, is the Neuberger Berman doing a nice job, about 1% of the plan. I'm going to go clockwise around these nine boxes here. So over to small, I'm sorry, counterclockwise, so then, or clockwise, excuse me. So then small blend, you're going to have both an index and an active manager with Columbia and BlackRock. And then over to small value, victory small cap opportunities, about 1% of the plan. We have another victory fund managing the mid cap value category. That's 1.3. And then fairly low price stock, which has been in the plan for 25 or 30 years, doing a very nice job at 1.6% of the plan. And then we use two large value funds, the Putnam and the JP Morgan, both doing a nice job. Last but not least, in the middle of it all, is our mid-cap blend category. So companies $2 to $7 billion in size. So we both have the index and the active manager, principal being the index fund. Below the nine boxes, we mix in a mix of individual categories or sector funds with our international funds. So we have two foreign large growth funds, which are the Vanguard International Growth and the MFS International Intrinsic Value. So a growth and a value is two different choices there. To the right of that is the emerging markets. So China, India, Russia, Brazil, Mexico would be the countries you're investing there with American funds, New World. And then we have a global fund. Global means you have US and overseas contained in the same fund. Below that, sprinkled around are specialty funds. So global commodity stock from Fidelity. So that was the best performer last year with commodities taking off. Technology was one of the worst performers with technology taking a big hit. And then over to the bottom left side, we have real estate, which struggled because of higher interest rates. And then you see the gold category, which was down, but did better than some other investments last year. Right in the middle, asset allocation or lifestyle funds. So those are categories of funds where you mix stocks and bonds together. So we have a traditional balanced fund, which is 65-35 stocks to bonds. And then American funds target date, which are default funds for folks using an all-in-one investment that is based on their age of retirement and is going to rebalance their investments every quarter. Second page of this section here is going to be the safe harbor or the fixed income categories. There's about 38% of the money in the Prudential Guaranteed Income Fund, so that money has no risk. Did not have any loss last year, but that money is just earning interest on your principal, so dollar in, dollar out. And then to the right of that is more traditional bond funds, so principal bond market index, right above the Goldman Sachs Inflation Protected, which is on our red flag list. And then American Funds Bond Fund of America, which is a combination of both corporate and government bonds, somewhere in the 5 to 8 year maturity is your intermediate term choice. So those are the categories where the money is allocated. Now we look at what we call our asset diversification, which is showing you all the investments from high risk to low risk, showing you the dollars held in each fund. So on the left-hand side, for reference sake, are the numbers, the style, the name. the symbol they trade under. So these are symbols you can look up under a lot of different financial websites. And then the assets held on those funds to start this year. And then the percentage that we just saw on the previous page in the style boxes. And then in bold here is telling you how many current or former employees, all participants that are holding money in each one of those funds. We always want to be careful to push down expense ratios. So on the far right, we give you an idea of what the expense ratios are in each one of the funds. And then what the category under where it says CAT is the category average from Morningstar and all those funds as well. So down the way, you reference fund number 14, just as a reminder again, that one's red flagged. And then fund number 32 is red flagged. And then if you look at the overall plan assets, 153 million. There are currently 55 loans that participants have taken against their balance. And that's roughly 1.1 million. Overall, there are 345 people holding balances in this plan. We referenced in green here back up on the sheet, the five biggest holdings. They'll happen to come up on the second page. But the biggest holding is the Safe Harbor Fund, the principal of Prudential Guaranteed, which is the number one holding. Number two is the S&P 500 at 10% of the plan. Three is Hartford Core, four is Prudential, I'm sorry, Putnam. And then five is T. Rowe Price, all cap opportunity. So those are all large US stocks. So pretty typical to see that in a retirement plan. So we're still on the Prudential platform, but as we all know, Empower has purchased Prudential. So this is the fee disclosure format that they provide. So this lists all of the funds you have in the plan. It's the symbols first, then the name, then the share class. In almost every case, we're either using the institutional, the Y share, or the R5 or R6 shares, which are typically the lowest cost or very close to the lowest cost versions of the funds that exist in the marketplace. These numbers are as of 9:30, so they're always a little bit behind, but this is the prior quarter to this quarter. So giving you the balances there, the plans were smaller than they are now since the fourth quarter was up. And then it gives you the expense ratio of each of the funds. So there's both the gross and the net. The gross is what the fund can charge by prospectus. The net is what they are charging. They multiply those balances by the expense ratio to get the annualized cost. And then of that, some funds pay back to the plan, some of their expense ratio to cover plan expenses. So 12B1 fees, in this particular page, there aren't any 12B1 fees. Sub-accounting fees, which would be typically a fee that would go back to the record keeper. But you see some funds pay and some funds do not. And then there could be a finder's fee. There's not on this particular page. And then they kind of total up here the additional contributions to record keeping. So some funds pay in a different method. And then the total amount is going to be total on the right-hand side. So in essence, say Putnam Large Cap Value has 10 basis points in sub-accounting fee, 15 in additional contribution, so 25 basis points. So of the 36,000 a year that they charge, 14,000 they pay back to the plan. So there's a good number of funds that don't have any refunds just because they don't have any of those particular charges. Typically index funds being low cost as they do not refund any of their expenses. So if we take it all down to the total here, averaging dollar weighted, it's about 10 basis points in aggregate or about 167,000 a year that is raised from the funds to cover plan expenses. So 31 basis points is the dollar cost weighted average of the plan. So very competitive in terms of the marketplace there. And then of that 31, 10 is used to cover plan expenses. So the money managers are making 21 basis points and 10 of that's going back to the plan. So we total it up on the next page. So 10 basis points, 167. Our team is a 6 basis point fee or about 100,000 a year. And then the remaining portion goes to Empower / Prudential. And so they're entitled to 3 basis points, which is 52,000. Right now the fund is raising 62,000 for them. The additional $10,000 goes into the expense account, which is owned by the plan that we use to cover the transaction costs for employees when they take loans or distributions or hardships. And also Stephanie uses for legal costs for the plan attorney. All right, any questions on the balances, fee disclosure, asset diversification? All right, now we get to the fun part. It's your items for review. So we'll start with the 401A plan. I realize we have some new members of the committee, so I'll spend a few minutes going through an example of the format that we use. So we subscribe to a third-party software product called Zephyr Style Advisor, which is one of the bigger products in this industry. It allows us to create a custom charting method to evaluate mutual funds versus a series of benchmarks. We've kind of developed this format over the last 20 years, seems to be the best way to look at funds overall. So we're starting with the top two charts are the same chart, but just different time horizons. We call them a risk reward scatter diagram. So what this is telling us is what the return of the fund was after the expenses. And then it's also telling us what the risk of the fund or the daily volatility was in terms of comparing that to the benchmark. So the top chart, and we're using an example here. These are not necessarily funds in your plan. One of them actually is, but only by coincidence from our example. But the benchmark here is Russell 1000 Growth. So this is an examination of large U.S. growth stocks. So we want to see our funds hopefully above the benchmark, which means they're outperforming net of their costs. So net of expenses, they're beating the benchmark. And then if possible, we'd love them to be the left of the benchmark, which means they're doing so with less risk. That's hard to do, but that's kind of the perfect place we're hoping to see funds end up. So if you look at funds here, there's four different funds. Where you wouldn't want to be would be the Alder Spectre Fund, which is underperforming the benchmark on both the three-year and five-year chart. As you can see, the arrow says it's underperforming with higher volatility. That's where I really think we would have risk as fiduciaries in terms of having an underperforming fund. So certainly that's not an option in our plan. We would be happy with JP Morgan Growth Advantage, which is outperforming the benchmark with a touch more risk. The AB large cap growth might be okay. It's less risky than the benchmark, but not quite at the benchmark line in terms of performance. There's a second benchmark on here, which is called the capital markets line. Capital markets line goes from the bottom left corner, which is the point in which you could have your money just safely in treasury bills, earning interest without any risk, all the way up to the benchmark itself. So it's a way of measuring risk versus reward. And you could see a fund, if it's a little bit less risky, and gives you a little less return, that still might make sense. So AB is close to that, not quite at it on the three-year level. It is right above it on the five-year level. So the ideal place is where the T. Rowe Price All Cap Opportunities Fund is, which is outperforming with less risk. And it's actually one of the funds in our plan. So in the bottom left here is the calendar year return. So the eye wants to go read the other direction, but the most recent period is on the left. So it's giving you your 2022 returns as of the end of November, and then 2021, 2020, et cetera, all the way back to 2018. So we kind of look for outlier years, like JP Morgan Growth Advantage had a really nice 2020 and then a decent 2021, but not a great 2022. So it kind of gives us a way of looking at the fund, both in aggregate and year by year. And then the style, so what do they actually own? Are they a fund that matches their name? Do they own large growth stocks? If the benchmarks are also 1000 growth, do they own a lot of the same stocks? You can see none of the funds are identically on it. They're not index funds, but they're all close. So the JP Morgan and the Alder Spectre are pretty much pure growth funds. They don't own anything on the value side. AB would drift a little bit to the right of the, or left, excuse me, a little bit left of the benchmark, which tells us they have a few value stocks in there. And then T. Rowe Price has even further to the left. So they all put a few value names in there as well, even though they're still overall growth fund. And then all of those funds are a little bit lower than the Russell 1000 growth, which says they'll drift and buy a few things in the mid-cap category, but still maintain their categorization by Morningstar in large growth. So then the second chart we'll look at here today, and only if we are dealing with considering alternatives with this top chart, is upside and downside capture. Now, what does all that mean? It's an idea of looking at when things are good, how does your fund do? And then comparing it to when things are bad, how does your fund do? So for a long time, the markets were so good, largely between 2009 and 2021. There wasn't a whole lot to worry about. So you still had to use this chart to kind of figure out which funds played defense, which played offense better. But we certainly in 2022 have a good example of that, unfortunately. But you get an idea here how funds do in different time frames. So if you look at the JP Morgan Growth Advantage, you can see it's right on that benchmark line. So when the market's up, it's giving you about the same return or 100% of the return of the benchmark. So what that means is if the market's up 10%, they're up 10%. And then if your eye follows it from the yellow circle down to about where that arrow is, it's giving you maybe about 97, 98% of the downside. So the market goes up 10, they're up 10. The market goes down 10, they're down 9.7. Where you certainly don't want to be is Alger, because when the market's up 10, they're only up 8.4. But when the market's down 10, they're down 10.4. So that's certainly one we want to eliminate. The fund that we're utilizing is giving you about 93% of the upside and only about 87% of the downside of the benchmark itself. And that's a benchmark that's set with their same category. Last chart we'll cover here is what we call the floating bar. So it's giving the returns, again, the most recent periods on the left all the way to the right. And it's showing you all the funds in the industry, every fund that you could choose from in the large growth category. So you can see the disparity of returns. So on the year-to-date numbers, there were funds that were only down 15%. There were funds that were down 42%. So a huge disparity. And then we've color coded these. The blue would be the best quartile, then green, then purple. Red would be the worst. So red has a bigger disparity. So it's a little bit bigger box. So the funds that look good, our T. Rowe Price looks very good performance-wise, staying in that top quartile and even extending beyond that top quartile on the 3, 4, and 5 year return. So that's one of the best funds on the planet in this category. And then if we keep picking on Alger Spectra, you can see it performing towards the bottom and all those different time frames. All right, a lot to digest. Any questions for me and all that?
Scott, I had a quick question for you. This is Kevin. The capital markets line you mentioned on the previous slide, for the last few years that has been crossing at zero because interest rates have been so low. I just wanted to kind of revisit that a little bit and see kind of where that stands today, if I'm understanding that correctly.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's what I was thinking about as I was explaining it too. But that empty diamond here on the bottom left is the 3-year average rate for treasury bills, which at that level is still less than 1%, but that number is coming up pretty quickly. So as 2022 rolls off and into 2023, you're going to see that number pick up. So you're going to start seeing a flatter capital markets line. In other words, this diamond's going to move up, which is going to make this a less steep line. And that's part of the reason that some people are not hopeful about the markets in 2023 is because there's a lot of alternatives out there. You can make money, still be safe in treasury bills or something like that this year. But yeah, you're right. That's what's going to happen. For the first time that I can remember, you know, it's been probably a decade since that number was anything but zero. So that's going to be very different in these charts in the next few years. So it'll still intersect with the benchmark. It'll just be more of a flat line rather than a more of a diagonal line. Good question. Anything else on that? All right, so let's dig into our funds. So we have referenced the percentage of the plan it represents here, 1.39%, the name and symbol of the, I'm sorry, the name and share class of the fund. There's 72 employees in the fund. So this is the MFS technology that we want to look at today. So not on the red flag list, but one we want to bring up because it has underperformed. So a reminder, the top chart's the last 3 years. So you can see it's fallen below the benchmark. It does take less risk than the benchmark, but is underperforming. And if you look at the 5-year, the fund actually still looks quite good because it's in that Northwest quadrant where it's outperforming the benchmark with less risk. Now, the MFS Technology Fund did lose money last year, but not as much as the benchmark. So we can see the blue bar versus the black benchmark. Its actually worst year that's hurting it on this 3-year chart is not 2022, it's 2020, which was a huge year for technology stocks when we were all staying home. And you can see the category is up about 58, and they were up maybe about 53. So that's what the difference was in terms of the 3-year chart. So page 26 has the longer term. This page 27 has the shorter term look. So the 6-month look is at the top. So still a little bit under benchmark here. But the 12 month, you can see it actually did a little bit better. So it's kind of the first half of last year, they did better than the markets, and they just didn't do quite as well as their benchmark in the second half of the year. So this is MFX Technology. Overall, they still get a 3-star rating from Morningstar. Just to explain Morningstar's terms, 5-star is the best, 1-star is the worst. And then they have a secondary rating, which is based on their outlook on their process. So gold would be the best rating, then silver, then bronze. So your Olympic medals are something easy to remember. There is a 4th place, however, which is your neutral. And then a 5th place, which is they consider a negative rating. So they don't think the team running the fund is any good. So now I'm going to show you on page 28 some funds we could consider that you could use to replace what you have here. Now in orange, I'm going to reference the BlackRock Technology Opportunities because that is already in your 457 plan, already an option for your participants. Now normally our process is to take a fund that is underperforming and red flag it first, unless we feel like it's struggling enough that it needs to be replaced on the spot. I don't feel that way, but we did want to offer the alternatives in case we wanted to go through a discussion as a committee today. I think that red flagging it would be plenty to get started, but we certainly want to talk to the committee about that. If you look at the individual year-to-date numbers, MFS is kind of similar to the pack. A couple play defense a little bit better, 3 or 4 a little bit worse. So before we dig into the funds, any thoughts from the committee in terms of how we want to handle this fund?
Scott, I totally agree that I think this needs to be at least red flagged, but seeing some of the other alternatives on here, I'd like to just kind of hear your thoughts on what we're looking at as far as potential alternatives if we were to go that direction.
Sure. So the scale here is showing you the expense ratio of the fund. So that's the first number there in the parentheses, and then how long the manager team has been on the fund. So MFS, what we own, is 88 basis points, so just less than 1%, and then 11.6 years the team has been there. And then if a fund does share some of its revenue back with the plan, that expense ratio number is going to have a different number on the second page or second chart, which shows how much of that revenue they share. So MFS charges 88, shares 15 back with the plan. So some of them charge more or less and pay back more or less. It's not, it's really not linear in terms of the numbers. So you have some good looking options here. Fidelity Technology should be noted it's using a new manager. So manager's only been there for 2 years, been kind of a crazy couple of years for that new manager. The Columbus Element Information and Technology has the same manager for 33 years. Back when there's only Sullivan was a fund company not owned by someone else based out of San Diego. He's still the same manager that founded the fund itself. So great that he's been there 33 years. You always worry with long tenured managers, how much longer will they continue to work? But you see that you have a series of funds here. More risk would be like the BlackRock technology that we're already utilizing. So it's further to the right in terms of risk. The best performers of late have been that Columbia Seligman. There's 2 Columbia funds on here. And then the Philly Technology with the newer manager. And then upside downside capture is always helpful to look at the other managers. So we have the BlackRock Technologies giving you about 117% of the upside, but also 102 of the downside. And then the Columbia Seligman is giving you about maybe 111, 112 of the upside, maybe only 91% of the downside. Now, on the longer term numbers here, Columbia Seligman seems to be the winner on all those different intervals, but you can see MFS, the fund we have, is pretty solid middle of the pack over time. And again, tends to be a little less riskier than some of their peers. And then ranking wise, our current fund is 3 stars in bronze. BlackRock is 4 stars in gold. Columbia Global Tech is 4 stars and neutral. Columbia Seligman is 5 stars in silver. Fidelity Tech, 4 stars and neutral because it's a new manager. Danis is 3 in bronze and Putnam is 4 in neutral.
Yeah, I know it's, this is Jason. I know it's our typical our practice to move to a red flag stage before considering alternatives, but Kevin, I appreciate you pausing the discussion to look at the alternatives here, because I don't know, it's very Scott, you highlighted the Cumbria-Seligman fund. It's kind of tempting to consider switching to a fund with a 33-year manager and a 5-star rating, given that MFS is a 3-star fund right now.
Right.
But we traditionally have not done that. I know the policy allows it, but we've traditionally been a little more patient.
Part of this is this process is art and science. So we've covered the science. The question is, does anybody want to have a feel for what makes the sense here? We do go a little higher in terms of cost on that Seligman fund. So make note of that. It's at 91 basis points. But I don't think you're in a bad place by red flagging it. I don't think you're in a bad place by changing it. So.
Got on the chart in the bottom right, it seems like all the funds line up pretty well under the Russell 100 growth, and the outlier in that one, if I'm able to see the text right, is the Seligman one. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so what this is telling you on the chart here is that they're not as pure growth oriented. So everyone else is just straight up and down as growthy as you can be. They're much more value oriented, which is why they look good recently, because we've gone from a growth market to a value market. So when growth was doing really well, like 2020, you know, the benchmark was up 58%. Columbus Seligman was only up about 41, 42. So they just don't have the same aggressive approach of the market. If you look at the holdings in the fund, they just don't have the heavy big tech overweight that almost every other fund does, and typically every large growth fund does, where the name of the fund, the stocks are all the same, where it's Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet, Tesla, et cetera. So they kind of go off the beaten path a little bit, which has worked for them in the last 2 years, which is why it looks so good on those charts. So you still see those names in there. They're just not the overwhelming top 10. And given that they represent such a huge portion of the benchmark itself, you know, in Wall Street terms, we think of that they're actually underweight Apple, they're underweight Microsoft, even though it's 3.8% of the 3% of the fund, it's probably 9% of the benchmark. So they just don't own as much of those big tech stocks as other people do.
Scott, is that kind of reflected in the upside, downside graphic?
Yeah, let's take a look. I was going to look at the holdings here for MFS. I mean, given normally you would think because it's more mid-cap in terms of size that there'd be more volatility there. So normally you wouldn't expect it to have less downside capture, but I think the fact it's got more value stocks and value did so much better than growth in 2022, that's why that downside capture looks a lot better than some others. So I think if we go back to a market where bigger is better, big cap tech runs again, then I think they would probably lag, but markets usually don't work that way. Once you have a significant bull market that's broken by a bear market, the next cycle up is typically has new leaders. It won't be the same stocks as before.
I know it's not our typical practice, but this Seligman fund does have a lot of upside, at least from my perspective on this, that I think that that's something that we should really consider. Kind of jumping right from the being aware of it to straight to a new fund versus a typical red flag approach.
Yeah, I can support that in this case. I think it's somewhat unique. So I would also be okay with making the change now and skipping the red flag stage.
Okay, that sounds good to me. Anybody in opposition of this movement?
And if I might suggest to the new chair, I think as we've done before, just have the board secretary keep track of each of these changes, and then we can adopt them all with a single motion at the end.
Sounds like a plan.
Oh, you're here. Did you just get done?
Okay. So it sounds like, pending a vote, that we are going to remove MFS technology from the 401A plan and replace it with the Columbia Seligman Tech and Information Fund. Okay, good work,
everybody. Any objections to that? We're just going to move on to the next one. Thank you.
So yeah, we'll still have a chance for people to vote on that or come up with opposition, but that sounds like that's our working theory here. All right, thanks for all the good input, everybody. So now on to the red flags. So in the mid-growth category, we have the JP Morgan and the Mass Mutual. Only Mass Mutual's flag, but we always show you the other option in the plan. One, because you kind of want to see everybody in the plan's doing in that category, but also there's always the option to merge one fund into another if you feel like that's the solution we want to have. So JP Morgan tends to be the fund with bigger upside and bigger downside. Its net rate of return on the 3 years right on top of the benchmark. If you're looking for that circle, it's right on the benchmark of the S&P Mid-Cap 400 growth. On the 5 year, you can see it's outperforming the market pretty handily, averaging about 11% a year return, the benchmark at about 7.5%. And MassMutual still looks fine on the 5 year chart, where they're getting a better return for less risk than the market, but they just haven't kept up with the market over the last 3 years. And it's not quite as much from the good years. It's more from the difficult years, where the 2021, which was still a plus year, they just didn't have the gains, but near to JP Morgan. But JP Morgan had a nice cushion from huge returns in 2019 and 2020. And then the difficult year of 2022, they both lost both more than the benchmark. JP Morgan actually losing more than Mass Mutual over that time frame. So 2020 was a good year for the category. It was a good year for the funds. And then 2022, the opposite there. So they still have nice looking 5 year numbers. So they certainly should be within consideration. JP Morgan over the last 5 years is in the 11th percentile. So what first would be best, 100th would be worst. They're also the 11th percentile over the last 10 years. Mass Mutual is middle of the pack for the last 5 years. They're 53rd percentile. They're 30th percentile over the last 10 years. So short-term performance is what we're going to look at here. So 6 months at the top, 12 months in the middle. So 12 months, you see JP Morgan with the higher risk when we know those returns for 2022. The biggest losses were in the first half, and you can see both those funds got hit hard. Worse than their benchmark, and actually JP Morgan worse than Mass Mutual. But as the markets had showed more signs of life in the second half, JP Morgan still underperformed the benchmark, but was better than Mass Mutual. Mass Mutual made a 1% return. The benchmark was closer to 3.5%. JP Morgan was about 2.75%. So the choices for today would be to continue to red flag Mass Mutual, to replace Mass Mutual, or to remove it from the red flag list. I certainly don't think we can do that. Certainly an option, but based on the 3 year performance with that funds down here, I don't think you could. And then the other choice is, does anybody feel like we need to red flag JP Morgan based on what we're seeing here from the last 12 months? Probably a bit early, but at least you're aware of it and you have the chance to discuss it here today. So page 39 is now showing you your options of funds we could replace this with. But before we dig into that, let me turn it over to committee to see how they want to handle this.
On the JP Morgan, Scott, I would suggest that still looks good enough on the 3 and the 5 year. And I think you've explained to the committee, and I assume you explained to participants that it is a volatile fund, right? And so I think the recent performance just sort of reflects its kind of expected performance in a down market. So I don't feel like it's doing anything we didn't expect it to do.
Yeah, well put, definitely.
So I don't think we need to take the step of red flagging it until it really crosses the line on the three or the five. So I think that one can stay. I think the Mass Mutual decisions is a little more complicated.
I think in previous exercises like this, we've, for JP Morgan, we've referred to a gray flag where it comes back to us for review and kind of keeping a close eye on it to see if it justifies moving it to a red flag category or future change. Is that an option that we can unofficially kind of put on there?
Certainly. Yeah. So Anil will just make note that we'll just show that fund in the next meeting either way, but not a problem. So in the options here, two funds are coded in orange because you're already utilizing these two funds. Delaware Ivy, you might remember, was just added to the 457, and Janice Henderson Enterprise has been a longtime member of the 457. So we have the ability to double up. Typically, committees not wanting to do that, but it is an option. I'd probably be adverse to adding Delaware Ivy Mid-Cap Growth this plan, as we just added to the 457 plan. I'd rather give it a little time and then just see how they do. But you're going to see why we added it, because the numbers look pretty good. So a few more things about Mass Mutual. I should mention, fund manager has been there 22 years. Mass Mutual, sort of like Vanguard, they don't have their own money managers. They outsource this. So at times, occasionally, Mass Mutual will change managers of the fund without you having to change funds. Having talked to them, that's not on their radar. They still feel comfortable with the fund and the management team. 4 stars is the ranking still for Mass Mutual, and it is bronze in terms of its evaluation of the management team. So now in the last 12 months, it's 30th percentile. So it actually kind of lost less than some people in 2022. Now that's a weird way to talk, because everyone lost money, but you can see that that light blue bar did better than some other benchmarks or some other funds, but definitely not as well as the benchmark. If you're curious, JP Morgan is 5 stars in bronze. But you can kind of see that Mass Mutual fund on the year to date is the square. You can see it was probably the second best performer. And right between the first and second quartile.
God, am I seeing this correctly? On that previous slide, the benchmark, which is the black diamond, fell into the top quartile.
You're looking at this chart?
This one right here, yes, page 40.
Yeah, so this is where, and I know Jason will remember this, many of you may as well, but we've had some debate over the years whether our benchmark for mid-cap growth should be the Russell mid-cap growth or the S&P mid-cap 400 growth. Russell will let basically stocks based on market capitalization into their benchmark. S&P only lets you in there if you're profitable. So in 2020, when every new name that had come public in the technology sector was rocking and rolling, going up 100, 200%, the Russell looked a lot better, because those stocks were moving, but many of them were not profitable. So the S&P mid-cap 400 was lagging. And now you're looking at the entire sector of mid-growth, many of which do follow the Russell benchmark, has fallen apart. A lot of those unprofitable companies, their stocks are down 50, 60, 80, 90%. So profitable wins again. So you're making a good point, Kevin, is that companies that actually make money in this category have been the big winners year to date, 1 year and 2 year. That was not the case in 2020. Let me go back to that here. So in 2020, you can see our little benchmark in black was up about 21%, but some of these funds are up 40, 50, and 60%. So if you chase what was hot, your numbers look good in 22, in 2020, but not so good in 2022. Like Vertus Car mid-cap growth in purple is a good example of that. Or ClearBridge, good example of that.
Scott, is the Janus fund highlighted because it's also in the other plan?
Yeah, so Janus has been the plan, that 457 plan for years and years. So. And that's a fund that, funnily enough, just to talk about it, because it makes a point about these funds, is that we did have to red flag it in 2020 because everyone's saying, well, the market's going up huge and they're only up 18%. What's wrong with these guys? Well, we found out they just didn't want to chase those unprofitable stocks. They had a decent 2021, and then they lost a third of what the benchmark did, or what the average fund did last year. So that's what, as a committee, we have to kind of be aware of these trends so we don't fall into the same trap that a lot of investors did.
How about considering Janus as a replacement, even if it's on the other plan already?
Yeah, I think I see what you're getting at, Reed. It does appear to be maybe the best. If we're going to keep Mass Mutual or keep this a second fund in this category as sort of a less volatile option here in the mid growth category, seems like Janus might be one of the better options. We've just traditionally been reluctant to have two funds, have a fund in both plans.
Yep.
Scott, looking at that chart here in the bottom right again, are we at any kind of risk that that fund is going to have a style shift away from growth and into more value? It seems like they're the kind of the outlier from that group.
Oh, that's always been the case. Yeah, I mean, they really a mid-growth fund. So, I mean, I've had even meetings with portions of their management team, but yeah, they don't really look like a growth fund at all as far as their holdings, but they still get that classification from Morningstar. So it's been that way for years. So I guess my answer to you is I don't think that's going to change, but it makes you wonder because they're far less, they're not even a growth fund on this, they're a value fund.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a strike against it. You know, what would be a strike or a positive for it is looking at it on this chart where it gives you 94 the up and only 85 the down, but it's not giving you any less upside capture than Mass Mutual that we already owned.
I think in other categories we've run with two funds where one is more aggressive and one is more conservative to give employees options, and I think this fits in line with that approach. So I do think that this Janus Henderson fund, although it's not a typical way we like to do it, offering it in both funds, it does present a more conservative mid-growth option for employees and has a good long-term performance.
So I agree with all your points, Kevin, but just to say it out loud, and I've already said it once, but just say it again, if we have another one of those piping hot markets, it's going to trail. JP Morgan won't, but it will. But maybe that's exactly what we want. It's going to get one that's going to rock and roll when things are good, one that's going to play a little more steady. So we got the tortoise and the hare approach here.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, fees pretty attractive, manager team's pretty attractive. And then I liked that they stuck to their knitting when they were taking a lot of criticism and seeing a lot of redemptions in 2020. So, like I said, we had calls with their management team because we've got that one in a lot of plans and just needed to have ammunition in terms of what their approach was. And it did pay off by sticking with it. So I'm okay with that. Anybody want to just keep Mass Mutual red flagged, or are we okay with making a change today? Is there any other fund someone wants to consider?
Got maybe just one question. What specific index does Vanguard growth index fund in this category try to benchmark?
So they are tied to the Russell Mid Cap Growth. So.
Okay. So that's why they're not right on the black diamond on our plot, because we're using a different benchmark.
Yeah, and I think we've shown you this chart to you a few times in the past with both benchmarks so you could see where it is. But yeah, if you're wondering why the benchmark's below the benchmark, it's because it's a different benchmark. Okay, so it sounds like without a vote yet, we have a working theory that MassMutual comes out and Janus Enterprise goes in. Kevin, Jason, thumbs up?
That's my recommendation.
I'm good with that.
Okay, we're all in agreement. Let's move forward. So into the bond category. So bonds and some metrics had the worst year ever in bonds, certainly the worst year in my lifetime. So going back to the 1960s in terms of bonds. So even inflation protected securities, which are guaranteed by the US Treasury, but tend to have a longer duration, which means their maturity dates are further out in the future. So you have to wait longer to get your principal back. So they're impacted greater by moves in interest rates. So we're using the Goldman Sachs inflation protected securities. Please note the scale on these charts is very compressed. So we're going from a 2.5% rate of return to a 0% rate of return on these charts. So our eyes get used to the distance between the dots and the lines. We're in pretty good shape here, but it is a bond fund. So it's always gonna be more compressed in terms of its returns. So our fund, which we red flagged two meetings ago, has made about 1.25% per year for the last 3 years. The benchmarks, it may be a little over 2%. And over 5 years, it's fallen below the benchmark. Not significantly so, but by 0.25% or so. And if you look at the individual years, essentially they were good in 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, or just close in 2021. It was this year that got them. Now, when you're a bond manager, you have to worry about credit quality, you have to worry about duration, you have to worry about coupons, all of that. But in this case, there's no credit quality issues. It's always just about duration. So it's just a guess which way interest rates are going. And it looks like they've just been a little bit too aggressive in terms of that. So it is a longer duration portfolio. In the last 12 months, they're middle of the pack at 55th percentile. The last 3 years, they're 70th percentile. They get a 3-star rating from Morningstar and neutral for their process. So this is showing you 6 and 12 month numbers. So the 2022 number that we already saw, which has been their bugaboo, is illustrated here on those charts. So alternatives we could consider, again, in our second review here, we'd love to show signs of improvement, not really getting that at this point. So we have these options to consider. We went off script a little bit and offered a short-term inflation-protected securities fund too from Vanguard. So it's not incredible a management skill that is giving you the numbers you're seeing, it's just they have shorter duration. Less durations impacted less by interest rate rises. It's also impacted less by interest rate falls. So if rates start to come back down, which seems they started to do so in October, they won't make as much money if interest rates were to continue to fall again. So looking at these options, we can keep Goldman red flagged. If we wanna make a change, the ones I would focus, well, probably the one fund I think is worthy of the change would be the American Funds Inflation Linked Bond. So that is this one on both charts, kind of the X. So fee is 30 basis points, manager team been there 10 years, they do not share any revenue back with the plan. It should be noted Goldman is charging 34 but sharing 10, so they're only netting 24 in terms of the expense of the manager. And then upside downside capture, American Funds is kind of right at 101 on the up and 101 of the down. And if you look at longer term performance, certainly the short-term bond fund looks fantastic, but longer term, it's basically been American Funds is the best over the 4 and 5 years. Then Goldman is 3 in neutral. We talked about that. American Funds is 4 stars in neutral. By the way, other than the Vanguard Fund and the PIMCO Fund, everyone else has a neutral rating for Morningstar. So not a category that generates a lot of excitement, I suppose. So we can probably keep it red flag, but if there's momentum to making a change, I think the American Funds would be a good home.
Scott, based on the holdings of this fund and what you kind of just said about anticipating rates starting to come down and the duration of their holdings, you know, do you have any sense if it can get back on track with the remaining time it has on our red flag window?
Yeah, so I looked at the 1 week and 1 month numbers. Goldman did look pretty good. So as rates have kind of come down since Christmas, you definitely have seen Goldman look pretty good on the sheet. So I do think that if the economy slows, we see a recession, that Goldman may have played this correctly. You know, certainly not last year, but maybe sticking to their guns and us sticking to them would be the correct move. That certainly could be the possibility. So. So I'm comfortable giving it more time. If I was just picking between the two, if we had neither, I'd probably pick American Funds, but you know, we don't want to change it for the sake of change.
I say we maintain the red flag for another quarter, and we'll, you know, by that time we'll be close to our deadline to make a final decision. But
I agree with that decision. Get more data, see how this fund is performing, and see how market is doing with interest rates.
Okay,
that's fine with me as well.
Okay, great. So working theory is that Goldman Sachs inflation protected securities and the 401A will stay in the plan as a red flag. Okay, that concludes the items for attention in the 401A. We would move on to the items for review in the 457. Any questions for me before we proceed? So 457, we added a red flag last August on the JP Morgan Emerging Markets Equity. It's about 0.8% of the plan. 36 employees have money in there. Please note the scale. I've never seen this with a stock fund with a scale so compressed, but 0.8% is the top end of this, and minus 0.8 is the bottom end of this. So our fund has lost about 0.8% over the last 3 years. On average, the benchmark has made about 0.3%. So you still have a 4-star and silver rated fund. Manager team has been there 17 years. Their track record is actually quite good. On the 23rd percentile for the last 5 years, 22nd percentile for the last 10 years. So you'll notice that they're still well above the benchmark on the 5-year chart. And that's on the basis of 2019 and 2020, but 21 and 22 have been pretty difficult. Emerging markets have certainly struggled in that time frame. Short-term performance, you know, as much as everyone has talked about what's happened in the emerging markets, China's struggle with the zero COVID policy, Russia essentially ceasing to exist as a world power and their stock exchange being closed for the last 6 months. Emerging markets have been tough in a stock and bond category. But ever since China reopened, emerging market stocks are doing quite well. The best in the world the last 3 months. So you can see once things got good, JP Morgan's riding the wave again. Still well below benchmark for 12 months, however. So this is a, you know, JP Morgan was the name of the mid-cap growth fund, but kind of a similar strategy here with this JP Morgan fund is they're going to make more in good times, they're going to lose more in bad times. So we have the ability to make a change. I think if you're looking at this list of funds, the two best funds on this sheet, well, American Funds New World is fantastic, but that's already in your 401A plan. That is the best performing fund on the sheet. American Funds tends to be lower risk. They tend to be about 80% emerging markets, about 20% international markets. So when categories are going down, they're always going to look good, but they're not going to have the same upside capture of emerging market funds because they're not a pure emerging markets fund. But I think the best pure emerging market funds on here are the one we have from JP Morgan and the William Blair. So the one we have again is 4 stars in silver. American Funds is 5 stars in gold, the highest rating you can get. William Blair is 4 stars in gold. But I'm pretty tempted to give JP Morgan some more time now that they're showing a nice recovery. And just to illustrate what I pointed out before, upside and downside capture, here's JP Morgan giving you 124 of the good and 108 of the bad. For an alternative, you have William Blair at 114 and 103. And then American Funds is much more conservative, 107 of the up, 91 of the down. So not a lot of people have money in emerging markets because it hasn't had a great decade, but it's probably due for a run at some point. Maybe all international stocks are. So if that was to be the case, I certainly think you'd want a fund that can capture upside.
You mentioned that William Blair is probably the best of the pure emerging markets. How has that been performing in the last few months? You mentioned JP Morgan's had a good rebound.
Yeah, I don't have the short term number. I didn't happen to look that up, but they were the worst fund in 2022. So. Yeah, I look at both of them as, I wouldn't say William Blair is better than JP Morgan. I think they're both very similar. So, but William Blair got hit the hardest of any of these funds in 2022. So they do get the gold rating, so they love their process.
I suggest we maintain the red flag here, given the essentially the performance has improved above the benchmark since we red flagged it.
That's right.
So it's sort of right, yeah, in the upper chart.
Yeah, so we red flagged in August. These are the numbers in June. So, yep.
So. I don't think it's done well enough to take it off red flag, but I think it's headed in the right direction. And so I'm willing to give it a little more time.
I agree.
Okay. So JP Morgan emerging markets, we're thinking we maintain the red flag on that. Thank you everybody for the input. Foreign large blend, we have the Parametric International Equity Fund, which has been on red flag for 3 quarters now. So going back to April of last year, note the scale on this chart is 2.5% to zero again. The fund has made about 1.5% a year the last 3 years. It's about 2.25% the last 5, but on both charts, slightly below benchmark. It had a good 2018, it had a good 2020, but the other years have been slightly below benchmark. Morningstar gives them 4 stars in bronze. The manager team's been on there 12 years. In the last 10, they're in the top 21st percentile, the top 5th, but in the last 1 and 3 years, the very middle of the pack. This is recent performance, 6 month and 12 month. So by our investment policy, they are not showing signs of improvement. I don't think this is a fund that's in trouble or anything like that, but it's not doing what we need it to do. So should we consider alternatives? Those are listed here. Broad variety of choices. I'll tell you the ones that I'm interested in. Actually, my favorite would be this MFS Institutional International Equity R6, which charges 67 basis points, has a manager team for 12 years. I think one of the things we liked about Parametric was the expense ratio was only 50 basis points, and that just hasn't kept up with that number. There's another MFS fund that looks pretty good on the charts. That's a fund of funds, so it should be noted that it's a fund made up of other MFS funds, so it actually buys six mutual funds to create a portfolio. MFS Institutional International is more traditional in terms of buying its own stocks. You can also choose from a Vanguard fund. And then eyes are probably going to that Fidelity Advisor Total International Equity, but that expense ratio puts me off. Ranking wise, our existing fund again is 4 stars in bronze. Fidelity is 4 stars in gold. The MFS International Diversification is 5 stars in silver. And then the MFS traditional one is 5 stars in gold, the highest rating. Then if we do upside downside capture, you can see this First Eagle Overseas is the outlier because they're much more value oriented. They also have about 20% in precious metals in that fund. But my favorite is up here, giving you the best upside and downside trade-off. I think international diversification is certainly pretty good too. Giving about 92 of the up and 90 of the down. Our existing fund giving you about 95 of the up and 97 of the down. And then the Fidelity fund is giving you about 100 and say 2 of the up and 95 of the down. The one with the biggest downside capture has actually been the Vanguard, but they're one of the best also in terms of upside capture. And then performance-wise, net of the industry, First Eagle looking good because they have kind of stayed out of the way of some of the downside over the markets. But over the long run, kind of on the 2-year, 3-year, 4-year, 5-year, MFS has been a pretty attractive option. So I think we can do better. I'd probably make a change here today, but that's our first decision.
This was red flagged in April of last year, is that correct?
Yeah.
So we'd be required to make a decision next meeting. Okay. I'd be inclined to go with your recommendation, Scott.
I concur with that.
Okay, so our thinking here is we'd remove the Parametric International Equity, replace it with the MFS International Equity R6. Okay, almost there, everybody. Thanks for hanging with us. The last two categories on here, we didn't actually even offer alternatives because we feel like it's too soon, but these could be red flag funds that we're looking at. We have in mid-blend in the 457 two choices, the benchmark index fund, the principles on the benchmark, so that's fine. But the Touchstone Mid-Cap Fund, which has had a wonderful track record, is definitely struggling of late. So on the middle chart, which is the last 5 years, it looks fantastic, outperforming with less risk, still taking a lower risk approach, but really missed out on some of the gains over the last 3 years. And they actually had great returns in 2018 and 2019, but 2020, 21, and 22 has been a rough stretch for them, both in the up and down markets. But this, we're showing you not a red flag fund, but showing you the 6-month performance. They're slightly losing money the last 6 months. The benchmark's made about 3.5. And then the last 12 months, they're lost about 7%. The benchmark's lost about 5%. So still 4 stars in bronze, long-term tenured manager team. They beat 80% of their peers on the 5 and 10 years, but the last 2 years or 3 years have been pretty rough, 88th percentile. So our feeling was, without offering alternatives yet, because it probably does deserve some more time, but we think Touchstone would need to be red flagged.
I agree.
Yeah, based off the short-term performance, we need to red flag this one.
Okay. Hopefully it hears us. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Those are items for review. Any items for consent that people have questions or comments on?
Scott, just one quick one from me. I think it's on page 128 of your numbering, I think 136 of the board packet. Just as glancing through this, I noticed that the principal fund here looked like it was below the capital markets line in both the 3 and the 5.
Yeah.
And so just curious if you saw that too, and if there was some mitigating factor that you didn't bring into our attention to consider red flagging.
I mean, I think that there's always a feeling among index funds that an index fund is exactly the same as the index. The index fund is just a way of investing in an index, but it still has a cost. It still has people coming in and out of the fund. And so the problem with a fund like this is that when the market in the bond area is going down and down in a historical fashion, they have no way of getting out of their way. They don't have a fund manager that says, you know, we should shorten duration, we should raise some cash. They don't do any of that. So when the typical investor thinks their safe fund or sees their safe fund down 10, 12, 15%, they just liquidate. So what happens is these guys have to sell bonds at a difficult period of time. And so they're going to always have a little bit worse performance if they have to carry cash for those redemptions. In this case, that would have helped them over the long term. It wouldn't. But it's just because they have to sell to raise the money because so many investors, regardless of what they own, as soon as they see a loss, they get out. And so you have to sell a bond in a disadvantageous market where no one wants to buy them. It's going to hurt your performance. So, I think index funds have a big place in the marketplace, but in the bond market, it can be difficult because there's going to be illiquid securities and that they have to liquidate at the worst possible time.
Okay, that makes
sense. I think if we loaded up 5 more index funds, you're going to see the same thing. We'll be happy to show that to you if we need to. But
okay, so it's performing as
it is not the principal index fund. The question is index funds. I think when it comes to 2022.
So. Gotcha. Okay, I'm good. I appreciate the explanation.
No, thanks for asking. All right, Chairman, that concludes my presentation. I think we need to go for a vote. Does anyone have a movement? I can turn that over to you, Chairman. Excuse me.
Okay, thanks. Christina, you got all the decisions from the committee?
Yes. Would you like me to repeat them?
No, I don't think that's necessary. Why don't just go ahead with a roll call?
Okay. Roll call, Director Rowe?
Yes.
Director Whitaker?
Aye.
Director Bilodeau? Director Bilodeau, are you still on? Does not look like it. Okay. Jason Dadakis?
Yes.
Kevin O'Toole?
Yes.
Okay, that motion carries with 4 yes votes.
Okay, thank you so much. Let's put this all on the consent calendar. Are there any announcements or reports? None, then I adjourn the meeting. See you next time.
Thank you, Scott. Good reports.
Thank you, Scott.
Appreciate it.